the intentions are always like,
they are really.
So,
but I'm so proud of you that you're getting everything done, pulling, you know, the shimmikaja.
Yeah, I made a checklist.
I remember your checklist. It starts with wake up, brush your teeth. That's how detailed his checklist is.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
What about you?
You never ask me.
Sister,
no one ever asks.
What is the latest thing that you have felt this feeling for?
Gym.
Ah, gym. Yes.
I was supposed to go to the gym. I told my... I'll sign up, bam, lockdown.
You know what I've realized?
But I'm okay, I've got like equipment at home.
Because you know, in the previous episode, we talked about comparing ourselves with people, and we talked about that in the context of working out and stuff. See, I've always thought about like comparing yourself in a negative way where you like, oh, I want to be like this person or I want to be like that person, that's why I'm doing this. Recently, I've gotten rid of that. And I've just started thinking about, no, I don't want to necessarily do that. I just want to feel good about myself. I just want to feel healthy, for example. I just want to feel healthy, right? And that's changed my perspective in so many ways when it comes to something like working out.
Do you feel that motivates you more?
Yeah, because that's why I can get away with saying so many things. There's a key, there's a trick to everything that we do in life when it's something that's going to be beneficial for us, right? Like working out, like studies, like prayers, like fasting, like everything that we... Cleaning, whatever. You just have to enjoy it, sister.
For sure.
If you don't enjoy it, it ain't going to happen. Just don't do it.
Totally.
Right? You need to
enjoy. Don't turn it into a chore.
Imam Khomeini talks about this in Adab al-Salat. You know I love that book, right?
I do.
It's just... The thing is, I can't understand it.
You know, it's challenging.
Yeah, it's really challenging, right? But one of the things that I did get from it is this, that look, he says that your salah is like food. And he says that the experts say that if you're not enjoying your food, you're not enjoying the taste, you're just eating it, you're not going to digest it as well.
Exactly. And it won't turn into minerals and vitamins that your body needs.
The digestive process doesn't start in the mouth. Mm. It starts in the mind. It starts in when you look at your food, right? So he says salat is like that. You need to enjoy it. You need to savor it. You need to love it, which we're far from doing, but you know we can get there.
That's
if
beautiful.
You enjoy it, then it's going to actually benefit you. What's the point? You're not enjoying it. Just move away.
It's a waste of time if you're not enjoying it. And you know, this might sound really, really weird because people think that, oh, religion, especially Islam, is constantly about mortifying yourself. Mm. But it's not.
No, it's not.
It's about... Not. What Martyr Beheshti says, brothers and sisters, fall in love. That's his opening line. And I actually happen to know someone whose life was saved by this single sentence, brothers and sisters. He was almost about to commit suicide, and then it's a long story. Yeah. But he heard the sentence, and he was like, yeah, that's what I need to do. I need to fall in love with my Creator all over again.
Because what happens is when you go throughout the vicissitudes of life, you realize that this attachment I had, that person I loved, that thing that I loved, it all falls apart in the end, right? It's going to happen. It's inevitable. If you don't have love for Allah, there's just nothing else. Why not just kill yourself? But let's rewind a moment. Salat is like that, but everything is like
everything
that. So working
like
out
that.
Is like that.
Yes.
You need to enjoy it. If you're not enjoying it, just stop.
It's a waste of time.
Oh, by the way, in Salat, we just need to point this out for the dear beloved youth out there. If it's wajib, we're not saying to abandon it because you're not enjoying it. There are times where you have to drag yourself out of bed or you have to force yourself
this
to pray.
This is about discipline.
Yeah.
But work on that process.
Yeah.
Work on it before you get into the salah. You know, you can't necessarily expect to be doing absolutely redundant, almost borderline head-on things all day and then expect the enjoy spirituality switch to be turned on the moment you say, Allahu Akbar. It doesn't work that way. You know, it's a process. And it takes time. Mm. And what better thing to invest our time in than building a bond, a relationship, an enjoyable bond and relationship with Allah.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much for being with us, brothers and sisters. You've been listening to Youth Station.
From myself and from Sister Zainab, we bid you assalamu alaikum. عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Wash your hands, wear a mask, stay home and stay safe. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have a precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. I wish that everybody how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
Round the World with Reporters. A typical day in the life of mother of four, Naomi Rantry, founder and CEO of Educare Family Support Service, a fundraiser in West London that uses public donations to help children and families during the pandemic.
We started this food parcel delivery in May. So we did that for about 13 weeks. The numbers were just increasing. We started on 7 on our first week, and it ended up being 200 every week.
First stop, a school. Earlier this year, the British government had to reverse its decision not to offer free school meals in the Christmas holidays, following a campaign by football star Marcus Rashford. Still, more help is needed.
If there's an issue financially, we could support them with maybe some debt management, some financial assistance. In other areas, it might be school uniform they need support with.
People who use food banks are generally double-income, low-wage earners. In struggling families, all it takes is for one parent to lose their job. Karina used to work in the tourism sector in central London.
I used to work part-time on a 0 hours contract, and it was like a normal life for me. Now I'm on a minus because I've stopped working. I had to ask for help. I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Living in a nondescript apartment in West London, Karina, whose husband does food deliveries, not only has to care for her 3-year-old daughter, but also her ailing father, who lives alone.
Everything starts to go really bad with him. Sorry, I'm crying. And because I'm the one who's obliged, you know, to help him, to look after him, because he's my only parent.
The Trussell Trust, that runs 1,200 of the UK's 2,000 food banks, say they gave out more than 1 million emergency food packages between April and September. Nearly 500,000 went to children. They also warn these figures are the tip of the iceberg.
Nearly 2 million people have used a food bank in the UK in the past year, almost 300,000 more than the year before. While the government has taken steps, charities say they're not enough, which is why they're relying on donations from the public to try and tackle hunger in the world's sixth largest economy.
In the absence of an income, many adults living with children in this country have reported skipping meals in the last 8 months. It's the last month of the year, and the nation of nearly 67 million is gearing up for Christmas. Without adequate government support and with food banks under strain, poverty may well rear its ugly head in more British homes. Saeed Pureza, London.
Give us a decent housing, requisition of empty buildings. That's what the protesters demand from the French government. With the support of human rights associations, these homeless or poorly housed people have made a list of huge empty buildings in the Paris area. They handed over this list to the police headquarters and required that the housing law be applied.
We can apply this law to house everyone, even the precarious homeless French. Thanks to this law, everyone can have a roof above his head. If everybody were housed, that would already resolve half of our problems. It would help us to continue other fights, like work and against discrimination. The requisition law exists. It has to be applied.
I don't have a house. I'm moving from here to there. Once they proposed me a studio with toilets and a bathroom outside, I was disappointed. Now it's been more than 3 years I'm demonstrating with this association, Right to Housing, because they do the right thing.
This building in the center of Paris is entirely empty. This building in the rich 8th district of Paris is also entirely empty. Same for this huge building in the Boulevard Haussmann, another rich area in Paris. The owners are often big insurance or real estate companies, and the value of these buildings increases more by leaving them empty than by renting the space to people. That's called speculation.
We have a law of acquisition of empty buildings, housings, and offices, but it is not applied nowadays. In Paris, the prefecture, therefore the government, can apply this law of acquisition. But we see that the politic of the government is to favor the property rights and the rights to speculate on property rather than right to housing.
300,000 persons are homeless or are poorly housed in France. The needs for decent housing are growing. The solution could be simple. In France, 3 million of buildings, houses, and apartments are empty. Millions of square meters of offices are left vacant, a record in French history. The requisition law exists since 1945. The last time it was implemented was in 1997. Under the rain and with the cold coming, a growing number of people are in a need for housing, and a decent housing policy is becoming urgent. Chris Denant, Paris.
Afghans are yet to wait for the rise of peace in their war-ravaged country, as the ongoing war in Afghanistan continues to claim the lives of large numbers of civilians, including women and children, on a daily basis. According to rights bodies, including Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, over 30,000 civilians were killed and more than 60,000 others, including women and children, injured in the Afghan war over the past 11 years. All conflicting sides, including terrorist groups, US-led NATO troops and pro-government forces, are being blamed for these casualties. However, some international bodies like the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, and other independent bodies, including Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, name chiefly terrorist groups accountable for much of these casualties. They also call on the Afghan government to bring the killers of Afghan people into justice via any possible legal attempt.
Unfortunately, nearly 100,000 civilians, including women and children, have fallen victim to the war in Afghanistan over the past 11 years. We call on the government to share its findings about these deaths and bring the accountable figures to justice.
This comes as experts believe there would be no zero civilian casualties unless the Taliban militant group changes its mind and accepts a new Afghanistan that differs from what it was before 2001.
Approval of a ceasefire by Taliban is highly important. They must realize that remaining indifferent to the suffering of people will have dire consequences.
Violence has been rising in Afghanistan amid intra-Afghan talks in Doha and U.S. troops withdrawal. Afghanistan remains in the 11 most dangerous nations list for children, according to Save the Children. Meanwhile, the International Committee of the Red Cross reported last month that Afghanistan remains the deadliest country for civilians. Half of the civilian fatalities include Afghan women and children. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
EU leaders told Turkey in October to stop exploring in the contested eastern Mediterranean waters or face consequences. Earlier this week, all EU states agreed that in their view, Turkey has made no positive shift away from its policy of exploring in contested waters and upped its threat of sanctions. Ankara urged the EU to act with common sense to solve the dispute, but ahead of Thursday's EU summit, Turkey's president made his stance very clear.
Any sanctions decision that can be taken against Turkey will not concern Turkey much. Since 1963, the EU is officially constantly imposing sanctions on us anyway. The EU has never acted honestly.
Germany, the current holder of the EU's six-month presidency, holds the key to whether sanctions will go ahead. However, Turkey resuming its gas exploration off Cyprus in October has angered Berlin.
In recent months, Germany has made an extraordinary effort to find a way to intensify the dialogue between Turkey and the European Union. Regrettably, tensions between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece have not allowed direct talks to begin, and there have been far too many provocations.
Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over the extent of their continental shelves in the East Mediterranean flared up in August when Turkey sent a survey vessel to waters claimed by Greece. The two European nations accuse Ankara of drilling for hydrocarbons off its continental shelf. Turkey pulled the vessel out in September to allow for diplomacy with Greece, but then sent it back to the area, prompting an angry reaction from Greece, France and Germany. However, Ankara seems unfazed.
On the Eastern Mediterranean, we will continue to protect our rights. Moreover, we will continue to protect the rights of Northern Cyprus until the end. It is never possible for us to compromise here. But if Greece really acts honestly as a neighbour, we will continue to be available at the table.
The EU created a sanctions program last year to punish what it calls unauthorized exploration in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Government leaders meeting in Brussels have adopted proposals aimed at trying to avert chaos at EU-UK borders in the event that Britain abruptly exits the bloc's rules and regulations at the end of this month when the Brexit transition period ends on the 31st of December. This as floundering trade talks between both sides continue.
No one understates the challenges that lie ahead, but it's important for the citizens of Europe that we do everything we possibly can to get agreement here.
France has made it clear it will veto any EU-UK trade agreement that does not safeguard the livelihoods of those involved in the French fishing industry. The big sticking point for Germany is ensuring that British firms do not have unfair advantage over EU firms, for example, via state subsidies. Hardline Brexiteers do not want to see a deal, as they are worried this would align the UK too closely to the EU. Equally, there are many people in the European Union who adjudge London to be extremely arrogant. This cohort does not want to see a deal, as they'd rather look on as Britain faces the full consequences of Brexit. Those consequences might include very restricted travel to the EU from the UK from January the 1st due to the 27-nation bloc's COVID-19 rules with respect to non-members. British citizens living in the EU would likely face all sorts of bureaucracy. Then, of course, there are warnings of dire economic consequences for the UK and possibly Scottish independence. We are told the key to securing a EU-UK future relationship agreement to avoid chaos in January is fairness.
This fine balance of fairness has not been achieved so far. Our negotiators are still working, and we will take a decision on Sunday.
Even in the absence of a trade deal with the UK, EU leaders know they already face many economic challenges.
We still haven't fully resolved the problems of very high public debt, private debt still very high, banking sector problems still very present, price adjustments still ongoing.
The prospects aren't looking good. As EU leaders continued their meeting in the Belgian capital, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stated there is a, quote, strong possibility a trade deal will not be reached. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The administration
administration of U.S. President Donald Trump is given the go-ahead to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the UAE. On Wednesday, the Republican-led U.S. Senate approved the deal proposed by the government. The contract, reportedly worth some $23 billion, includes the sales of the U.S.'s most advanced F-35 fighter jets and Reaper drones. Senators voted almost along party lines on two resolutions. All but two Democrats voted to block the deal, while one Republican broke ranks to vote against the sale. Trump had issued a formal threat to veto congressional efforts to block the weapons transfer. Those in favor of the deal described the UAE as an important U.S. partner in West Asia. Detractors, on the other hand, argued the UAE should not be armed with advanced weapons given its involvement in the war on Yemen. They also warned that such a move would ignite an arms race in the region. A couple of months ago, in a controversial move, the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The country trampled upon years of at least verbal commitment to the Palestinian cause by recognizing Israel. It also distanced itself from the majority of the Arab countries that have no diplomatic relations with Israel over the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. The UAE's recognition of Israel was said to be a precondition for its purchase of advanced weaponry from the United States. Therefore, F-35 jets and Reaper drones can be considered the payoff for turning their back to Palestinians. The United Arab Emirates, which is ruled by monarchs, has a bleak human rights record. The country is a staunch Saudi ally, the two of which have been leading a devastating war in Yemen since March 2015. The war has killed thousands of innocent Yemenis, including women and children, and has caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UAE also openly supported anti-government militants in Syria, exacerbating the suffering of the Syrian people by fueling the bloodshed in the Arab country. It has also been actively engaged in a brutal suppression of a popular pro-democracy movement in neighboring Bahrain. Abu Dhabi is now eyeing to seize control of southern Yemen, including a strategic island there, using its proxies.
Iran and Afghanistan have launched a railway that connects the Iranian northeastern city of Khaf to Herat in the other country. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart Ashraf Ghani attended the inauguration ceremony through video conference due to the global corona epidemic. The two sides said the project is a pivotal one that helps boost bilateral economic ties and collaborations.
With the completion of such an important project, the commodities of your businessmen could easily be transferred to Europe. With this railway, you can have access to Iran's southern ports, including Imam Khomeini Port and Bandar Abbas, and later on to Chabahar.
For his part, the Afghan president also said that the important project will give fresh momentum to economic ties between the two countries.
We jointly put iron on earth and soil to tie the destiny of the two nations to outline our future collaborations. I offer congratulations and wish the best for the two nations and governments.
The railway is about 140 kilometers long, and after being connected to Herat, it will be about 225 kilometers.
The Khaf-Herat Railway will enhance economic, cultural, and social exchanges between the two countries. It will see over 6 million tons of goods transported annually. It will also link Afghanistan through Iran to the Caspian Sea, Russia, and Europe. Humayun Abedi, Tehran.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use our, have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population five times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity. But also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized U.S. administration's comments and actions against Turkish arms deal with Russia. In a presser, Erdogan, however, said he would discuss Turkish-U.S. relations with the next president once he takes office, just like it was the case before.
Once he assumes office, we will surely sit down and discuss certain things with Mr. Biden, just like we sat down and talked in the United States or Turkey in the past. We will discuss these again. We do not find the statements and actions they make regarding our arms procurements to be nice. We especially don't find their approach in northern Syria to be right.
Turkey and the U.S. ties have been hit by Turkey's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia after the U.S. was unable to seal a deal on Patriot missiles. Despite the ongoing tensions and sanction threats, everyone could see the chemistry between Erdogan and Trump. The chemistry that Erdogan-Biden relation is definitely not going to have. Analysts worry about the future of relations between Ankara and Washington.
Turkish President's statement on Turkish-U.S. relations is aimed to build a good relation with Washington, especially now that Joe Biden will take office. However, it is not guaranteed that things will go well due to differences between the two allies. The U.S. still insists on its support to Kurdish militants and tries to impose its strategies on Turkey, which is not acceptable for the government here. Therefore, I think tensions will continue to escalate between the two states.
The tension between the two NATO allies goes back to 2003, when Ankara refused to permit U.S. troops to cross its borders to Iraq. The tensions escalated due to different views on the Syrian crisis and Turkey's purchase of S-400 from Russia. Despite the ongoing tensions, many believe that both Ankara and Washington need each other's support in different arenas. This will force Erdogan and Biden to talk things out. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. Supreme Court has unanimously rejected a baseless lawsuit filed by Texas seeking to overturn the presidential election result, dealing the biggest blow yet to Donald Trump's assault on democracy. In a brief one-page order, all nine justices on America's highest court dismissed the long-shot effort to throw out the vote counts in four states that President Donald Trump lost, namely Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled Supreme Court Rejects Trump-backed Texas Lawsuit Aiming to Overturn Election Results. Stay with us for more of David Smith's article. The U.S. Supreme Court has unanimously rejected a baseless lawsuit filed by Texas seeking to overturn the presidential election result, dealing the biggest blow yet to President Donald Trump's assault on democracy. In a brief one-page order, all nine justices on America's highest court dismissed the long-shot effort to throw out the vote counts in four states that President Trump lost, namely Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The decision hammers another nail in the coffin of Trump's increasingly desperate effort to subvert the will of the people and deny Joe Biden the presidency. The lawsuit filed by Ken Paxton, the Texas Attorney General, sought to invalidate the results in four swing states, asking the court to extend the deadline for election certification so alleged voting irregularities could be investigated. It was backed by Donald Trump, 17 other states, and 126 Republicans in the House of Representatives, more than half of the caucus, including the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California, and the Minority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana. President Trump has long expressed hope that a disputed election would go before the Supreme Court, to which he appointed three justices during his term, ensuring a 6-3 conservative majority. Earlier, on Friday, 11th of December, he tweeted, "If the Supreme Court shows great wisdom and courage, the American people will win, perhaps the most important case in history, and our electoral process will be respected again." But just hours later, his hopes of a political miracle were all but extinguished. The Supreme Court wrote, "The state of Texas motion to leave to file a bill of complaint is denied for lack of standing under Article 3 of the Constitution. Texas has not demonstrated a judicially cognizable interest in the manner in which another state conducts its elections. All other pending motions are dismissed as moot." We'll be right back. Officials in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Wisconsin had derided the lawsuit as a publicity stunt. More than 20 other attorney generals from states including California and Virginia also filed a brief on Thursday, urging the court to reject the case. Josh Shapiro, the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, welcomed the Supreme Court's ruling. Shapiro said our nation's highest court saw through this seditious abuse of our electoral process, he tweeted. He tweeted, this swift denial should make anyone contemplating further attacks on our election think twice. Democrats in Congress also expressed gratitude. Eric Swalwell of California tweeted, the Supreme Court, a mix of conservative and liberal members, united to defend your vote against Donald Trump and his democracy deniers in Congress. And Senator Ben Sasse, one of relatively few Republicans to acknowledge Joe Biden's victory, signaled that it was time for the Republican Party and government to move on. He said, since election night, a lot of people have been confusing voters by spinning Kenyan birther type Chavez rigged the election from the grave conspiracy theories. But every American who cares about the rule of law should take comfort that the Supreme Court, including all three of President Trump's picks, closed the book on the nonsense. Courts have dismissed numerous lawsuits and appeals by the Trump campaign and its allies in various states. William Barr, the Attorney General and a staunch Trump ally, has said the Justice Department uncovered no evidence of widespread voter fraud that could change the outcome of the election. Saturday will mark the 20th anniversary of the court resolving the 2000 election in Republican George W. Bush's favor, but that was a much closer contest that came down to one state, Florida. Joe Biden gained 306 votes in the Electoral College, the same as Donald Trump in 2016, and leads the national popular vote by 7 million. Some Democrats have accused Donald Trump and his Republican backers of sedition. Chris Murphy, a senator from Connecticut, said in a floor speech on Friday, 11th of December, those who are pushing to make Donald Trump president for a second term, no matter the outcome of the election, are engaged in a treachery against their nation.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان العين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salaamu alaykum, dear brothers and sisters. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. And welcome to the program of Islamic Upbringing, here on IRIB English Radio. In this program, we discuss the problems and questions the parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmi Aqum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Miqdad.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
So Brother Miqdad, one of our listeners, she has a question. Let me read the question for you. She says that, you mentioned many times about protecting our children from cartoons, from Western environment, violence seen in the news, and so on. I feel that overprotecting a child will make them unable to cope in the real world when they grow up. So Brother Miqdad, it's actually an important question. What do you have to say about it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let's rephrase what we said about this. What's important to realize is that many things in a child's life will have an impact on the child, right? And if you remember what we said, that tarbiyah is, or Islamic upbringing, is to try and give as much ground, prepare the grounds basically for a child to make the right choices and decisions when they grow.
Right.
And the decisions that one makes in their adulthood or young adulthood and so on is based on a huge number of factors, a huge number of influences that they've had. And these have influenced their worldview, the way they think, their values, their principles, their moral compass. All these things are influenced and affected by parents primarily, but also environment, things that they've seen around them, whether it's through the virtual in the virtual world, through social media and cartoons and animations, or through the real world, whether it's teachers or friends and companies and mosques and etc. So when we talk about parents' role, we don't necessarily or we don't actually mean that we should create a bubble around the child in a way that there should be no influence from the outside world other than the parent. That is actually quite impossible to do, and not even something that parents should try to do, right? So we're not talking about protecting the child in this way, that that closing all the doors, throwing the TV out of the window, closing all the doors, and the child has no interaction with the real world. No, that's not what we're talking about. However, at the same time, we're not talking about the opposite of that, which is to completely let the child free to bear and to receive any sort of influence from anywhere outside, right? And then in the name of allowing the child to explore the world on their own and make their own decisions, that's not going to happen either. That's like telling a young apprentice to work with a woodworker, for example, or the carpenters, for example, and say, here's all the tools in the world and do whatever you want. Right? The child will damage himself and there'll be an accident very soon. What we're saying is that parents have the duty to actually give tools to the child, right? So to open the window slowly, slowly, whilst at the same time equipping the child in a way that they're able to bear the different challenges and the different influence that will come from the outside world. And this is the key that we're talking about.
So they have to give children the tool and also teach them how to use it.
Exactly.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Brother Miqdad, and your listeners, stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
So welcome back, dear listeners. We're discussing about providing the children with tools. So Brother Maghdad, please continue.
Going back to the question that was mentioned, regarding cartoons, so we said when we discussed animations and cartoons in general, we said that the solution is not to switch it off completely. The solution is to slowly, at first, make sure that we choose what the child watches. To make sure that we are giving them that which they are able to understand and that which won't create any damage. And then slowly opening the door for discussion, giving the tools to the child to understand, allowing the child's intellectual ability, allowing the child's moral compass to form slowly, based on Islamic principles. And once that's formed and you've given them the tools to be able to judge, the tools to be able to say what is right and what is wrong, based on that, you can open up the door slowly for other things as well to come in, right? So we're not saying close up the doors completely. We're saying just equip the child, number one, and make sure that these things come progressively, that the child is interacting with the world, but holding the dad's or the mom's and the mom's hands, basically, while they're doing this. And this is fundamental, and I think it's quite logical and quite rational as well. I don't think anybody would have any excuse, any issues with that. A message quite common is that we all do that as well. We never expose a child completely to any sort of outside influence, because we know a child can't bear it. Children are born with a kind of potential to understand good and bad, but this potential needs to be actualized, basically. And this happens through the help of the parents, through time, through thought, through a growth that will happen at all levels, whether it's physical, spiritual, intellectual, social, or even emotional, basically. And so these things are important to take care of.
Through experience.
Through experience, yes. Coming to the example of violence, for example, right? There's a certain age where a child just cannot bear certain violent images. And they will have psychological impact, psychological damage that can be done to a child that sees violent at a certain age, right? But at the same image, for example, if it's shown at a later age, or if the child interacts with this image at a later age, they are more able and capable to deal with it, right? Because their ability has grown, their understanding has grown, their moral compass has grown. So they're more equipped to be able to bear this. And this is what we're saying, basically. You, at the beginning, you cover it. You don't show it to them. You don't expose them to such violent images, for example. But when they're older, then they themselves will go into it. And parents just have the duty to make sure that they are helping the child to bear with it, to deal with it. If the child has any question regarding this, the child has any weakness and understanding, or is emotionally affected by this, then the parents should always be there to support them. So we're not saying completely overprotecting the child in an exaggerated way, but rather being the child and helping the child to deal with it. And again, this is something that if you look at any work that has been done in psychology, in development psychology, for instance, you realize that this is quite studied, basically, the impact of violence in children at from a young age, the impact of seeing certain scenes, whether it's sometimes not even violent, but for example, sexual content, for example, things that are related to very fantasy and magic, for example, children cannot bear this or cannot understand it, cannot grasp it in a way that is suitable for them. And that can have psychological effects, can have emotional effects, can have sometimes even physical effects, basically. So we have to be careful of these things.
So it's not like we completely stop the children from watching the cartoons, but we select what they should watch, what they need to watch, like the proper content. So thank you so much, Brother Maghdad, and dear audience, thank you so much for staying with us, and we'll be right back after a short break.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
So welcome back, and let's continue our discussion. Brother Maghdad, can you please continue?
Regarding the last point that was mentioned, the question about the influence from the Western environment, again, we need to be very clear what we mean. We don't have any issues with the Western culture as such and the positive things that will come out from Western culture or from Western environment. I know that there's a lot of positive things that the West has to offer, that the society has to offer for our children, and we don't deny that. However, we have to understand and be fair and open about it,
yeah,
without any fear that there are very striking and very important differences between the ideology that the Western culture and the Western identity will come with, that is in complete opposite with the ideology and the worldview and the values that Islam teaches.
Yeah.
And that's very important to realize at first, admit to these differences, mm-hmm, understand these differences, and then realize that if this is the case, if really there are differences, then I have to make sure that I teach my child that we live in a Western world, we live in an environment and in a culture that is surrounded by an ideology that many a times is completely in contrast and completely contradictory to Islamic ideology.
Yeah.
And therefore, we're not frightened to be part of the Western society, mm-hmm, to be part of the society, general open society, tolerating others, respecting others, being a good citizen.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we know that our ideology is different.
Yeah.
And we need to teach our children that. We need to teach our children, equip them with skills to be able to decipher the differences between a Western ideology, a Western worldview, and an Islamic worldview that's built on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the servitude of Allah and the obedience of Allah and the absolute perfection and eternal ability of the soul to live eternally and with eternal happiness, with having benefited or having been surrounded by the blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is, again, something that we equip our child with, something that we teach our child with, but at the right time and with the right methodology.
Mm-hmm.
Too early on, and you've spoiled the entire image that the child needs to have, and actually maybe even damage it. But too late, and actually, or ignoring it completely, and actually we're allowing the child to explore a world on his own or her own without any tools, without any guidelines, without any torch to go into the darkness.
Yeah.
That's actually quite dangerous. So we have to be careful, make sure that we equip the child, give them the right tools, the right understanding, the right emotional tools as well, the strength, the identity, the pride in Islam, and the worldview that Islam teaches. And these will play a very important role in the child being able to cope in the world and be a true and a good believing Muslim whilst living in a very secular, very Western ideology society. And being actually a positive impact on a society as a whole. And this is not something we call overprotecting. This is something we call upbringing, just generally.
So thank you so much, Brother Meghdad, and dear audience. This was your host, Hassanain, and I'm really thankful to Brother Meghdad for being with us. And dear listeners, thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. And visit us at our website, parstoday.com. And until another program, God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.